Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for thanks especially to Vlad and Colin for letting me speak during this spot, which may have sort of been their spot, and they were kind enough to let me speak. Anyway, today I'm going to be talking about protoplanetary disks again, but I'm going to be this talk was motivated by the discussions that we've had in the past 3 weeks that I've very much enjoyed, and in particular, there's in the protoplanetary disk community, there's sort of been this paradigm shift towards this idea that magnetic fields may be driving accretion not through turbulence, but through wind instead of turbulence. And so what I'm going to be talking about today is that, but also kind of get more into the details of this new paradigm and show that maybe there are some regions where you still have turbulence in addition to a wind, and how can we probe this further. Okay, so the big question we're all trying to answer in the protoplanetary disk community, apart from how planets form, but this is related to how planets form, is how does angular momentum transported and mass accreted onto the star? It can either be done radially, like a viscous spreading of a disk, or removed vertically, like through a wind. And of course, the sort of old paradigm is that magnetorotational instability would be the source responsible for the radial redistribution of angular momentum. So this is an animation of a torus around a black hole, but it demonstrates the point. The MRI gets going, and the disk viscously spreads. A lot of mass is accreted inwards and loses its angular momentum, and a little bit of mass is spread outwards with almost all of the angular momentum. And so this is nice and clean for black hole disks because it's fully ionized gas, and you don't really have to worry about any of these non-ideal effects that come into play, which I'll describe in a moment. And so that's part of the reason why it's moved towards a wind-driven sort of picture of angular momentum transport, where now you have magnetic fields threading the disk through like a Blanford-Payne type of mechanism where the magnetic fields torque the gas and accelerate some of it outwards with most of the disk's angular momentum, allowing the mass to accrete onwards. So the problem arises with the realization that these disks are cold throughout most of their regions. Only very close to the star do you get sufficient ionization due to thermal ionization of alkali metals. There you can have something like ideal MHD turbulence. But further away, you have these non-ideal effects. And there are three of them that come into play when you account for the presence of neutrals. Yes?
I can't read the rest. Would you mind reading them?
Oh, sorry. Yes. I apologize to those who may be colorblind or if it's too faint. So ohmic resistivity, right, so this has electrons and this has ions and this is neutrals. This is magnetic field. Thanks. That might help. Maybe. Well.
This says
front. Okay.
Oh, that was turning on the
wall. Okay, well, I'll describe it in words anyway if you can't see. Okay, so the idea with ohmic resistivity is that you're in a relatively dense environment, and there the electrons and ions are very largely coupled to the neutrals, and so they decouple from the magnetic field. And so the magnetic field effectively slips through the gas through a diffusive process. At the other end of the spectrum, you have ambipolar diffusion, and in that limit, it's really the electrons and ions are strongly tied to the magnetic field. You're in a lower density environment, and so the ions are only coupled to the neutrals weakly and through collisions, and so the magnetic field can still influence the gas, but the degree to which it influences the gas is the number of ions and how frequently those ions can collide with the gas. And in between, in between regime here, the Hall effect is basically arises to due to electron ion drift. And one way to think about it is that the electrons are sort of more tied to the magnetic field, but the ions are heavier, they have more inertia, and so they tend to collide more with the neutrals, and that can lead to their electron ion drift, which leads to this Hall effect here. And I'll describe, this Hall effect turns out to be important in the inner disk in particular, and throughout sort of the middle of the disk, and I'll get to the implications of that in a moment, but just to put it all in context here, this is a plot of the where each non-ideal effect dominates over the others, in terms of the magnetic field strength in Gauss and the particle density. This is the neutral density in inverse centimeters cubed. And so I think on top of this is the minimum mass solar nebula. So obviously there's some variation here. But the idea here is that you can get the Hall effect dominating throughout most of the inner disk. Maybe the ohmic regime comes into play at very high densities, although then you're, yes?
Is this with or without dust?
That I'm not sure about. I think it's with dust, but I'm not sure.
So is some assumed ionization fraction in this plot? Or some model for it?
Yeah, I'm not, again, I'm not entirely sure. To be honest, I just stole this to give you an idea of sort of where, I mean, there's sort of large error bars on this because you can change things by including more or less dust. The type of grains matter, which is a point I'll get to in a minute. But this is just sort of give you a rough idea.
Yeah, how was B calculated for, how was the field calculated for the minimum mass in this case? Is it like apoportation? What's the?
I'm not entirely sure, to be honest. Yes.
Sorry. Sorry, you should answer Vlad's question now.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to say the whole point of this plot is just to give you a rough idea of where things lie. I don't actually know the details of what went into making this plot, unfortunately. But I mean, I took it from Phil Armitage's review, so I don't know all the.
The field is not defined with a minimum mass nebula. You're just using the y-axis to define what field value you want. Okay.
Yeah, no, I understand that, but that's a question that usually comes up. Like, what is the typical field one uses? So that was, I mean, this line, right? The red line crosses many values of B. To me, that looks like they chose a value of plasma beta. So the question is, what value is that, and why they chose that value?
I think that line tells you what the density is of a function of radius. It doesn't tell you about the field.
But then why isn't it?
Yeah, let me get to Omer.
I don't think anything is assumed, right? Because the relative magnitude of these terms only depends on B and N.
That's right. Yeah.
That's one thing I did learn from this program.
Right.
But right, the red line is making some additional assumptions when you map it actually.
The relative magnitude does, but the importance of these overall.
Right. That's not in this plot.
It's not in this plot.
Well, again, this is just to demonstrate a point. I wouldn't put too much quantitative out of this, other than just low density ambipolar diffusion dominates high density ohmic diffusion, and in between the Hall effect, and that's sort of demonstrated by now a more qualitative picture of this cartoon here. Did I answer everyone's questions to satisfaction? Okay. So this new paradigm has. I split it up into two pictures because it actually depends on the orientation of any large-scale vertical field that's present with the rotation axis of the disk. And so if your disk is sort of rotating around this way, what happens in the Hall effect regime depends on the alignment of the magnetic field with the rotation axis. Okay, so in that region, you get, when the fields are aligned, or the field is aligned with the rotation, you get strong magnetic torques, and I'll get to that in a minute. And then in the anti-align case, you get sort of a weak or no accretion limit. And then further out, you get this ambipolar diffusion dominated regime where the ambipolar diffusion can sort of quench the MRI, maybe not make it go away altogether. And then you might get some ionization in the upper layers due to FUV. And on top of that, if you have a vertical field, you inevitably launch winds, and those winds carry angular momentum away as well. And so the big question right now is, what drives accretion? Is it winds? Is it turbulence? Is it both? Is turbulence even there? And these are questions I'm trying to address in this talk. And so let's look at this paradigm a little more closely. And so a lot of the talks so far have been global, beautiful global models that have included all these physics, or at least some simplified versions of these physics. You've seen this by Junying Bai and Zhaowan Zhu. And I'm going to be presenting local models. And while local models can't capture the full dynamical range of what winds can do. You don't get to see the whole outflow to infinity type of setup that the winds present. But the local simulation still can tell us something about the physics of what's going on locally without any of these sort of complicated large-scale gradients that come into play that makes it hard to discern what's exactly going on at any given radius. So for those of you who aren't familiar, the local shearing box approximation is a small cutout of the disk, and it's a co-rotating patch of the disk so that at the center of the disk, we're at zero velocity in our frame of reference. And then we set up a Keplerian shear profile, and that's what you see here in this density movie here. And the patch is small enough that you can ignore curvature. Those are second order effects, and you basically have a Cartesian domain here. And you can ask me questions about the details of the setup if you're curious. Afterwards, I could spend quite a while on it, but that's the basic tool that we're going to be using here. And in all of the simulations, because of the importance of the net vertical field, without a net vertical field, a lot of our calculations have found that you get no accretion or very, very weak accretion. You need a net vertical field, so we impose that in our box. The problem is that, well, even in global simulations, it's a free parameter. But so in this calculation, we have to set that a priori and define what it is. And so that's a big unknown. What is the magnetic field strength in these systems? And I'll be talking about that as well. So we use an ionization model based on chemical networks. We include X-rays, cosmic rays, FUV photons, and also you can see these references for the details of the chemical and chemical network. And as a result, we have all three non-ideal effects included in our simulations. I use both Athena and Pluto here in this work. I've used Athena for almost all of my simulations to date, but at the time when I was working on the Hall effect, the Hall effect was not in the public version of Athena, so I went over to Pluto and collaborated with Geoffroy Lesueur, who put that into Pluto. So that's why I have that. Otherwise, they're very similar, and we actually find similar results to Juning's work with Athena, so it actually makes no difference in this case which code we use. Okay, so let's first focus on the Hall-dominated regime, and so kind of the regions 1 to 30 AU-ish or so. So again, like I alluded to before, you see dramatic differences in what in sort of the accretion behavior and the stress behavior, depending on the orientation of the background magnetic field in these boxes. And so this is actually from Juning's work. And what you see is in the BZ greater than zero case, for a beta naught of 10 to the 5, beta naught is the ratio of gas pressure to magnetic energy defined at the midplane. So that's a relatively weak field. At 5 AU, you get this sort of laminar structure here. And this is just the toroidal field component being shown. But if you were to look at the Maxwell stress, which is what is the primary contributor to angular momentum transport, there will, of course, also be a wind component, a BZB phi, if torque. But in the midplane, you will also see a BRB phi component. A very laminar stress develops, and it's a large-scale stress. And that persists throughout the entire simulation. If you invert the field relative to the rotation axis, you either get this sort of diffusive behavior or nothing really at all in the midplane. You might get some stuff in the upper layers. I believe in Juning's calculations, this was just due to the FUV layer that he imposed.
What is H over R?
Well, these are shearing box simulations, and so you don't really have an H over R. You have a...
But you said it. I mean, you said it corresponds to... How do you know it is?
How do I know what?
One condition is... Oh, you mean it... You wrote something I didn't understand. H over R is much less than 1, so...
Yeah,
How can you know when you have a shearing box?
Well, that's sort of the assumption that you make
it will be applicable to...
Yeah, okay. Right. If you have a thick disk, this won't work.
If you took a
5 AU point... So this is not stratified, though?
This is stratified. This is stratified. Stratified shearing box.
You're showing the stress or the B out of plane?
What's that?
You're showing B out of plane or the stress?
This is the toroidal B toroidal component of B.
So if it is stratified, you know the scale height,
yes? Yes.
So that's the answer to
it. So we don't know the radius.
Well, here we do. I mean, I guess you can do the conversion, but I mean,
You know the radius because you put in the physics, which I think depends on the radius.
Yes, that's exactly right. Normally, shearing boxes can be sort of radius-free, but in this case, they can't be. Depending on it, all depends on what ionization physics you put in.
Is it easy to understand why decreasing plasma beta kills it off, kills the butterfly diagram off? It's pretty high, 10 to the 4, right?
Yeah, so it's not entirely sort of. So I know how it does it in the ambipolar limit, and that might be what's also going on here, because despite this being sort of the Hall effect dominated regime, ambipolar diffusion still dominates in sort of the upper layers, because there the density is low. And so what happens is the ambipolar diffusion, the diffusion parameter itself is proportional to the magnetic field. So a weaker field, so if you make the field stronger, you quench the dynamo in favor of this more laminar configuration. And weaker field, you don't.
How the temperature is determined?
These are very simple isothermal calculations. So yeah, there's no fancy thermodynamics. I have a student working on that, but nothing fancy. Certainly not like your models.
What is the basic contrast between V-plane?
Up to here? Again, these are Jeuning's models, but I'm guessing that's about a 10 to the 4, 10 to the 6 decrease. And that's what it is in mine, too. Okay, so now, so those were Jeuning's models. We ran, we meaning in this case me, Matt Kuntz, and Geoffroy Lesueur, ran calculations of the same thing with Pluto. And we found actually slightly different behavior. This is the volume averaged quantity of the Maxwell stress and the Reynolds stress. So this is sort of the canonical alpha value, and volume averaged. So this is the time history of that. And with BZ greater than zero, you see this rise up to large values, and then it just remains flat. And that's the sort of laminar steady state stress that develops in the box. And then in the inverted case, you actually do get this variability instead of what Jeuning found, which is basically nothing. Now you might point out, well, you just made this claim that Pluto and Athena are essentially the same. What, you know, isn't this different? Well, we tracked down the differences, and it turns out just to be sort of the assumption in the microphysics, and this is sort of getting to perhaps Neil's point, is that you can change things dramatically by whether you include dust or what type of dust you include. And so in our calculations, we assumed 10 micron grains, right? So this is the range of models that we produced for these are various numbers, but I really just want you to look at the blue lines here. This is the amount of ambipolar diffusion in sort of a dimensionless unit. So going up here is actually a decreasing ambipolar diffusion. Going down is increasing, and for different assumed grains in the diffusivity calculations. So you bigger grains, you get less diffusion. And so we actually did a model where we assumed a higher ambipolar diffusion, which would be equivalent to, we didn't actually increase or decrease the grain size manually, but we just artificially increase the diffusion, which would be equivalent to making the grain size smaller. Then we find values consistent with what Jeuning found. So the point here is that...
Was he using a full chemistry network and everything?
Yeah.
Grains and all of the,
yeah, that's right.
His grain population was simply different from yours.
I went and looked back at that this morning, and I think that's the main idea. When we first chatted with him about it, he actually said that it's just what came out of his calculations was a higher diffusivity, because his network is different. I think it's actually a little more advanced, to be honest. These calculations were using Matt Kuntz's chemical network that he did for star formation calculations back in like 2009. But really, we get diffusivity parameters that fall within the range of this uncertainty. So the point is, even if his network is more advanced, the point is you can still change things slightly and get a different behavior altogether.
Jake, yes? I have a question. So tell me why the dust matters.
So dust basically sets your recombination rate, right? And so, and Neil can correct me if I get some of the details wrong, but if you have... smaller grains, you get more of them, And so that leads to a larger fraction of your electrons being soaked up. And so you lose a lot of charge due to that. So a recombination can happen quickly on dust grains. Is that right, Neil? I think
the recombination rate is roughly proportional to the grain's geometric cross-section.
So from the point of view of the gas physics, the grains are basically just setting, or they're influencing the ionization fraction.
Yes.
So they're a catalyst. They don't really take anything out of the gas. They just, it's like...
They're not active players in the dynamics, but they're just influencing them.
Well, I mean, right. They're not thought to be active players in dynamics.
Like condensation in the air if you have dust.
Yeah. So in the simulations, are there actual grain particles?
No.
You're just...
Yeah, so what we do here is we just assume a certain abundance of elements. We run a network to sort of find the steady state distribution of carbon, sulfur, blah, 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 and also account for recombination onto grains. And we assume a certain size for what the grains are. And that's what this range is up here.
The grains, from Chunin's talk, the grains tend to go where the pressure is highest.
Yes.
Large grains on there.
Only large.
Well, it sort of, yeah, it, yeah, yeah, mostly. So none of that is actually included in this, and it's an interesting avenue to pursue to actually, self-consistently include grains and then the chemistry and all that. It's expensive, very expensive, but which is probably why no one's done it yet. But yeah, that's a good point. And in fact, MHD turbulence, even these Hall regimes show sort of the formation of these sort of pressure, high pressure region, so one that would be interesting to explore.
But even just the grains would then rain out into the midplane, and there would be not much above and below, so you would have
right.
Clarification of the...
I mean, and that's coupled to how much turbulence there is, right? So if there's a lot of turbulence, then you get a puffed up layer. It's as Xuning said this during his talk, but everything's coupled.
Okay.
And it's rather frustrating because you can't run radiative models with chemistry solved on the fly and dust dynamics included in magnetic fields. And this is only a local model. Trying to do that in global models is a nightmare. But, this is a step towards...
Let me completely hijack this discussion then. So are grains evolved as tracer particles in some sense or not? Because they want to follow the flow, but not...
Well, they aren't involved in these calculations at all.
No. Okay. But if we wanted to put them in, I'm just curious. In cosmology, people looked at this and they found that if you just put a tracer particle and if you move it at local velocity, it totally decouples from the gas because truncation errors for the gas evolution and for the particle evolution are decoupled.
Hmm.
So they had to do special things. I was just curious if there was an understanding of how to even move the dust around properly.
Huh, that's interesting. I mean, I have calculations of the streaming instability, which is a whole other talk, not even related, other than they use shearing boxes as well, where we do include dust, but...
So
we can talk
I'm
about that.
I'm aware of that work, and my take on it is that in protoplanetary disks, if there's small particles which basically follow the flow, they're either assumed to be well mixed, as Jake is doing right now, or maybe using a dust fluid. So the individual particles aren't, their trajectories aren't important. You're just worrying about the density. And then for the streaming instability stuff, that stuff is, then you're not so well coupled, and then it's a different numerical issue in that.
All right. So what are the? Oops, sorry. What are these bursts? So basically, what we've shown them to be in this paper is a non-axis symmetric version of the Hall shear instability. And so, for you MHD aficionados, I'm going to go into a little bit more detail of what the Hall shear instability is. It's sort of related to the MRI, but it's not the same thing. Actually, it's the Hall shear instability which drives this large-scale laminar stress as well. Okay, so thinking sort of a vector space here, maybe not quite vector space, but we're looking down now on the shear flow, right? So it's like looking down on these shearing boxes, right? Okay, so for the BZ greater than zero case, the magnetic field is pointing out of the page here, and in the other case, it's pointing inwards. Okay, so let's start with some toroidal field. What the Hall effect does is there's a current that depends on the orientation of this field. And so in the case where it's aligned with the rotation, in this case, you get a radial field that's negative for a positive toroidal field. So you generate negative radial field from positive toroidal field through this Hall current. Now in the MRI, it's simply rotational dynamics that does this. The Coriolis force, basically, does this for you. But you don't need that in the Hall effect. And so it's the Hall current that does this. And so what you do is you generate radial field from toroidal, and then that leads back into more toroidal field through to just due to shearing out of the radial field. So you amplify the magnetic field as you shear it. But in the inverted field case, you get the opposite effect. You actually get, for a positive toroidal field, you get positive radial field generated from the Hall current. And that will damp out because the rotation's in the opposite direction. So that's why you get nothing except for these bursts, which I'll come to in a minute.
Sorry, which one was bursty? Sorry.
This one's bursty, but okay. Not in this picture. This is sort of a axisymmetric view of the Hall shear instability. Yeah. And so here's a cartoon way to say that. BZ greater than zero, you get radial field from toroidal, and that shears back into toroidal field. But in the opposite case, you get radial field pointing the opposite direction, and that just cancels out the toroidal field. But what's left is you can get non-axisymmetric modes. What I described was an axisymmetric version of the Hall shear instability. You still can get non-axisymmetric modes. And I believe the main reason is that it's actually not omega dot b being the main parameter. It's k dot b times omega, or k dot b times k dot omega in the linear dispersion language. So basically, your perturbations have to be k dot b in the vertical field case is along, there's a component along the vertical field, but you can also get k dot b along the toroidal field. So that would be KYBY or K5BY.
So I'm not familiar with this enough. For BZ equals zero, that's the actual zero point of this instability. It's not, because you're balancing, what's happening to this Hall current with the rotation, and it seems like, the zero balance, it's not clear to me that it happens at BZ equals zero. Is that?
Oh, so at BZ equals zero, I would imagine that these non-axisymmetric modes would still be there, but we haven't. This is a question I had actually a while ago, and I never got around to testing it. But at BZ equals zero, these non-axisymmetric modes would still come into play. What happens is that the sort of large scale or the axisymmetric version of the Hall shear instability, it doesn't create large scale toroidal and radial field, which is what it does in the aligned case. It removes that, but you're still left over with whatever non-axisymmetric modes come about. These non-axisymmetric modes are also present in the aligned case, but they're just swamped because the axisymmetric behavior of the instability completely dominates.
Is it similar to MRI in the sense that the growth rate of the fastest growing mode is basically the dynamical time irrespective of the field strength?
No, it's the dynamical. Actually, I need to think about that. I need to go back.
The MRI has this curious property that in ideal MHC, if you take B, the limit as B goes to zero, you still have the instability there. It's just on very, very,
right.
Very high K.
Right, which is weird.
which is weird. I'm wondering if this is what.
Yeah, I need to go back and look at the math to. I'll get back to you on that.
Like from those simulations, the higher the beta Z, the easier it is for this burstiness to happen. So it sounds like in the limit of beta infinity would probably be in favorable energy for this.
Well, I think the burstiness, we haven't done a whole parameter study, but the burstiness, whether it's there or not, strongly depends on the diffusivity of the code. Its dependence on beta is less clear. And so what's actually happening is it's actually not a true linear instability. It's a transient phenomenon. It's an instability that grows off this transient. Omer's nodding his head because the same thing happens in the non-axisymmetric MRI, but now it's the non-axisymmetric HSI. And so it's another cartoon. I like cartoons. What we have here is, again, we're looking down on our shearing box, and this is sort of a wave that's imposed, and it'll be shear amplified from trailing to, or from leading to trailing. And as that happens, the amplitude of the perturbations will go into this regime that's HSI unstable, along the toroidal field, and then it'll come out. But if it can bootstrap itself while it's in the unstable regime, and you get nonlinear fluctuations, that can sort of sustain it. It's not clear whether this is what is causing the damping out, and so that's why it's bursty, or if it's related to the diffusion parameters. That's not clear. Worth investigation. Okay, so that's right. So that's the basic idea there. And I guess sort of my takeaway point on for the inner disk is that winds are important, as Juning has showed, and these calculations also demonstrate that, although we didn't focus on it. But radial angular momentum transport can either arise from a laminar magnetic stress like this one, or through these turbulent bursts via the HSI. And so, I got my PhD working on turbulence, and so I feel a loyalty to it. So turbulence can still be important in the inner disk. That's my sort of takeaway. Yes, Neil?
You need turbulence to explain the SEDs. You have to have dust suspended in the atmosphere.
Right.
It doesn't have to be magnetic turbulence, but you have to stir it up somehow.
Right.
Is that an all radii or a large radii as well?
Large radii, you have like bigger than 20 AU or so. You have scattered light imaging that shows that there's dust in the atmosphere. Smaller radii, the SED.
Oh, in the infrared, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, I've been talking with Neil a little bit about this and Joan about how can we probe. I'm not going to talk about it here because nothing's been formalized yet, but how can we probe this physics in the inner disk? And, I'm tempted to try to see if there's any bimodality, like if half the systems have aligned fields versus anti-aligned, which is an assumption, right? Could there be something that we could pick out? But I suspect the data is very messy and it's not going to be easy, so it's just a shot in the dark.
Jake, what sort of mixing properties would this bursty turbulence have in terms of the associated alpha value with the turbulence?
Right.
Like that? What sort of what's
that like? Oops. So this is the alpha value.
Okay.
So 10 to the minus 3-ish. It's not negligible. Again, the period here, it's not a well-established period either. A few tens of orbits maybe, but it's not well-established, like I said. So, it's not clear, but it's certainly not negligible.
Does it cover the full height of the box? Or
no.
More in the mid-plane?
Yeah. So here's the plots. You get some stuff happening up here, which I'm not entirely sure what that is. It could be just if you look at it, it looks like it's
could be
propagating. Well, it could be or buoyant motions. It's hard to see. This is a stress plot and not actually looking at the field itself, but rather the correlation.
Yes.
But you can sort of see a diagonal line, which may imply that it sort of something moves upwards, but it launches primarily at the midplane.
There's an extremely well-defined height in
here?
Pattern. Yeah, I mean, it's a cloud deck.
This is probably due to the ionization structure that we employed. If you account for X-rays, FUV, and cosmic rays, even with a sort of a gentler attenuation of cosmic rays, it's still, like, if I can show you later, the ionization level plots are, it's like a very sharp decrease, and I suspect that's what that is.
Like that well-defined height is that same location that blue stripe on the other
could
be as well.
This?
Like, so yeah, the same characteristic that you have.
Are these results consistent with global simulation?
So no one's seen this in a global model yet, but you need 3D for non-axisymmetric, of course. And I think the only one that's done that so far is Jeff Wall. And I don't know he only did a handful, maybe even two. I was just reading his paper the other day. I don't think he saw it, but it doesn't mean it's not necessarily there. Again, there's a lot that probably could kill it. Depending on what you assume for the diffusivity.
Is the convergence of this understood for the resolution?
No. This was the first. These were the first simulations that saw it. And once we saw it, I was sort of done, ready to be done with this paper, so I published it, and really haven't gone back to it since. Although.
Fair question, Sasha.
No.
I don't mind.
I don't think anything is understood, so maybe this is at least understood.
You mentioned the wind.
Yes.
Is it going to influence the wind of the wind, and these are totally separated?
I think that's pretty separate. Again, this hasn't been studied in detail, but this is primarily happening on the midplane, and winds sort of launch from around here, so this would be pretty separate.
So in a global context, you would probably have patches, like, in a shrinking box it's pretty hard to change BZ,
right?
But in a global context you will have turbulent component of BZ.
That's right.
So then you will have patches which are dead, patches which are alive.
Right.
And if you have large-scale field of one sign, you will still have convergence.
Right. No, it's an interesting point. Actually, Phil Armitage, I wasn't involved in this work, but he likes these sort of fancy short ideas. And one thing he invoked was to explain XORs. I wish Lee were still here so he could comment. But XOR outbursts, based on the flipping of the dynamo of the star, and how that might influence the Hall effect, which is kind of a neat idea. Yes.
What is that class of source?
XOR. It's basically a sort of class zero outbursting, or is it class one? I think it's class.
It's a mini version of an FU4. Yeah. Okay.
That's my understanding too.
And Jean Marie's very excited about that.
All right.
Because they might be related to dwarf novae or something. Maybe.
Come on. Oh man, I can't fast forward past this. Sorry about this. Any other questions while I wait for this animation? I don't know why some Kino doesn't let me go through.
Explain what's actually going on. Why do we go up and then we go down? Because the orientation changes.
So I'll play it again. So basically, what happens is if you have perturbations in the magnetic field, the shear itself will amplify those perturbations. As the modes. So this is sort of representing that, although it doesn't show it very well because the color stays the same. But if you shear these perturbations, they get amplified and then they get de-amplified when the modes go from leading to trailing. And so this is the B amplitude, just sort of represents cartoon-wise what should be happening in these sort of modes here. So you amplify just to do the shear itself and you go into this unstable regime.
And what's shown here to be
these in this movie?
Yeah.
This is just some. This is just some wave. I think it was a density wave in this case. It's just to demonstrate the whole shear amplification idea. All right. So I said all that. Okay. So now for the outer disk, which is where we actually have some current observational data on. And I just wanted to say. As part of this Hall effect paper, I also wanted to make sure that the Hall effect didn't influence the outer disk. We didn't think it would, and sure enough, it doesn't look like there's anything difference between the BZ less than zero, BZ greater than zero case. The reason I did this partially was because the paper with Meredith, which I'm about to talk to, didn't include the Hall effect at all, even though we included some simulations where we might have thought it was important, but this was sort of a check that it didn't matter. In the outer disk. So we don't have to worry about any of this funny business with field orientation in the outer disk. In the outer disk, if you have FUV ionization, that's the primary way to get strong stresses away from the midplane. So this is sort of the total stress normalized by the gas pressure again. So this is like an alpha value as a function of height, time averaged, and average over the other dimensions. In the midplane, this gray region here, you get damping due to increased ambipolar diffusion, and then ionization from FUV in the white regions. And so if you look at what the turbulent velocity profile is, you get something like a U shape. It sort of depends on various parameters, but this is sort of the general shape you get. A very steep increase to almost the sound speed, if not a little over the sound speed, a couple of scale, or no, like 4 or 5 scale heights away, and then near the midplane, you get something between 0.01 and 0.1 in units of the sound speed. And so, all right, so that's what I just said. And so in the spirit of this workshop, this is our avenue to confront theory with observations, because we have this beautiful ALMA telescope that works in the submillimeter, so it probes best the outer regions of the disk. And usually I put a picture of a supercomputer up here, but you know I'm turning into sort of half observer or hybrid observer if I put up a telescope instead. But ALMA is really beautiful, and I wanted to put a picture of it anyway. So we use the ALMA to constrain this. What do we see this sort of turbulent velocity profile? Okay, so the way we did this, we made predictions first, of course, and I haven't done any global models, so what I do is I do a bunch of local models and sort of interpolate the results in a very rough gridded way. And it turns out to be okay, because the sort of turbulent velocity over the sound speed doesn't depend too much on radius. It sort of has that same U shape no matter where you look in the at least in these outer regions.
How large would the star be on the scale?
It's way very small. But you bring up a good question. This is all going to be in reference to the system HD163296, which is not a typical, it's not a T Tauri star. It's more massive. It's 2.1 solar masses, I believe, 2.2. It's a Herbig, the system's Herbig AES system, and so the star is like an A star, I think. And so the disk is big and massive. And that's partly why we are focusing on it, because it's very easy to observe. And so we set up all of our calculations with the right parameters. You have to adjust the density and everything appropriately.
Big and massive, but not gravitationally massive.
Not gravitationally massive. If you estimate the Q value, it's not. Tumor Q, yeah. Okay, so, and then from this we construct a delta V as a function of sound speed, sort of as a function of R through this interpolation, and then Z from each shearing box, and we run that through a radiative transfer calculation, and, well, I'm going to skip that slide, actually. But then we get model line profiles as one output of that calculation as a diagnostic, and the main takeaway here is that, unsurprisingly, increasing turbulence leads to the broadening of the line. But it's really the peak-to-trough ratio which matters the most in these line diagnostics, because there's this systematic uncertainty in the total flux. And so really you have to normalize everything to the peak flux and determine how much that trough is filled in. And that gives you a handle on how turbulent the system is. So we ran various models with increasing degrees of turbulence, usually fed by how deep our FUV ions go, or photons go, and how strong our field is, and then we characterize what the peak-to-trough ratio is, a function of that. But more important, especially for Alma, if Meredith were here, she would really emphasize the importance of the spatial domain on getting information about turbulence. And that's because turbulence, the degeneracy between turbulence and temperature can largely be broken in the spatial domain. Turbulence tends to spread out the flux, whereas temperature tends to brighten it instead of spreading it out. And so what you get is, in the no turbulence model, we get these very thin channel maps. And I'll describe what a channel map is in a second. And in the turbulent case, we get a more spread out image here. So channel maps, if you're not familiar with, it's just an image of the disk at a particular redshift. So this is the systemic velocity of the system. And so the disk is sort of tilted. And so you're seeing the front of the disk and the back of the disk at the point where the motions are completely in plane compared to you. There's no radial motions. And this is at the peak, the line peak. So these are, if you were to, it's hard to imagine, I know, and it took me a long time to see it myself. But if you imagine a disk and you break it into chunks based on what the redshift is, these are the images that you get out. And radio astronomers use these all the time as a way to image their data. And in this case, it's particularly useful because, again, the turbulence tends to spread out the flux. And it's a noticeable effect, even if from maybe in the back of a room you can't tell. But this is certainly measurable with this is detectable with our current instrumentation.
Can you just remind us, are these optically thin or thick?
So, right. So we've looked at a variety of lines, which I might... I'll come to that in a minute. This is an optically thick line, CO3 to 2, very optically thick. So we're only looking at the surface layers of the disk. So what do the ALMA observations tell us? Well, those of you who are at the conference will already know the answer, but basically we find in this disk that it's best fit. I'm only going to show the line profile, but this also applies to those channel maps. It's best fit with a very, very low turbulence value, 1%, maybe up to 5% of the sound speed for the CO3 to 2. So because it's an optically thick line, it's probing the layers where you should get on order the sound speed turbulent fluctuations. And instead, you're finding only a few percent. And so one might ask, well, maybe you just have a different turbulent structure than you think you do. And so you look at different lines which can probe different optical depths towards the midplane. And there even, and this is a paper that will hopefully come out soon, looking at other lines that have lower optical depth. You can probe towards the midplane, and there they find, again, very weak turbulence. And so this is 0.04 times the sound speed is actually consistent with what we see in the models, but it's inconsistent in the upper layer. So what this is saying is sort of that throughout most of the disk, you get an alpha 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 3 at most, but it's very weak turbulence, certainly inconsistent with what we expect. from MRI models, or any real models for that matter, because it's hard to, I mean, just sort of isotropic turbulence, you would expect that would be detectable as well. All right, so just to do a couple more takeaway points. So the outer regions of protoplanetary disk should be turbulent on the order of 10 to 100% of the sound speed, but observations suggest otherwise. So what's going on here? And part of this, as part of this paradigm shift and through some of the discussions, it's been suggested, well, maybe it's a wind that's driving accretion. And we see the signatures of the wind, and you might think that the answer is no, but I'm going to at least show you some preliminary calculations that suggest you should see various components of departures from Keplerian rotation from this wind.
Can I ask, are there dust scattering observations of this particular source as well? I mean, do you know that there's this high when they... altitude.
There is a paper, I don't remember the authors, where they put a constraint on alpha based on how scattered the dust is. Or no, that's of HL tau actually. HL tau, I don't think they've done it for HD163296, but they did this for HL tau, and for HL tau they claim that it should be alpha of 10 to the minus 4. And it should be a dramatic effect such that if you have alpha 10 to the minus 2 or so, it would blur away those lanes that you see. And HD163296 does have those lanes as well, so you could make the argument there that that's consistent, although no one's actually modeled it for HD163296.
But apart from the radial structure, that you know it's well mixed vertically, the dust.
Well, so
or that there is dust at high altitude.
No, that's the saying. Like, if the dust were well mixed vertically, those lanes would be obscured.
Well,
like,
we have to make a distinction. The millimeter-sized particles have to be settled into a layer with scale height much less than the gas, but submicron particles could be well mixed close to it.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
so
certainly
that's
true.
They're infrared observations,
I guess. I see. I'm not familiar with them, at least.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Can gravity observe any of these?
What's that?
Can gravity observe any of these? This
VLT.
Yes, I think it's infrared or optical. It's infrared. Because, I mean, they aim in the galactic center, but I was thinking if you can see dust here.
Yeah, I guess the answer is not. We should let Jake Galvis talk. Sorry.
It's all right. I don't mind the questions. Okay, so just to sort of demonstrate here that you can actually get magnetic wind type structures that develop in your shearing box if you increase the strength. And this goes to, I think, Sasha's question earlier. If you increase the magnetic field strength, what happens is the amplipolar diffusion becomes stronger. The diffusivity is actually proportional to the field strength itself. And so you can quench the... Oops. Oh. Press the wrong button. You can quench the MRI, and what you're left with is more of this laminar wind-type flow here. So you can see this is beta of 10 to the 4, which is weaker than beta of 10 to the 3. So what do you actually see in these types of calculations? Do you see anything that resembles a turbulence or anything like that? Well, here is that same profile of delta V over the sound speed for different magnetic field strengths. And the dotted line here is sort of the 0.05 times the sound speed, sort of the upper limit that was derived in our observational results from Kevin Flaherty's work. And the red and black lines here are at 100 AU, the two field strengths that give you a wind solution. And you can see it's well above this line. And I'll get to why that is in a second. But I also want to point out that if you assume very, very weak fields, even beta of 10 to the 7, you can still get large turbulence up here due to the FUV ionization. Remember, this is just beta 10 to the 7 at the midplane. So once you get up towards the FUV layer, it's a reasonably, it's like beta of, I don't know, 10 to the 3 or so, and you can get turbulence due to the MRI there. So what you really need is a weak field and no FUV layer. And that's, at least with the runs that I've done so far, to turn the FUV off and you have a weak field, you are consistently below this line. Now, what happens if you turn the FUV off and do a strong field? I'm still looking into that. That's very numerically challenging because the time step goes very small.
But observations also suggest that the velocity is a few percent of some velocity near the midplane.
Mm-hmm. Right, so...
Almost, I mean, constant.
Right.
So
What?
So this dotted line is not consistent.
Right. Well, this dotted line is just sort of a rough number. You can slide it up and down. But I mean, it was taken from this plot, basically, which Kevin Flaherty made. And he basically just points out where they use different tracers in this disk. And you see the 3H line here, H here. This is where the FUVs, photons should penetrate. And these are the upper limits they find as a function of all this. Yeah. I wouldn't really trust anything below 100 AU, but it's a good thing it's not a log plot then. So it's just focusing on the large scales here.
The optically thin line is the probe from the plane.
Yeah. Yeah. DCO plus is a deuterated CO charge molecule that has a very low optical depth.
I'm assuming that is also saying that in those regions it's very clarity, because what you're basically looking at deviations from clarity.
Right, that's right.
That must immediately also set limits on winds.
That's right. That's sort of what my point is that, right, and perhaps I should have said it already, but yeah, in Kevin's observations, Meredith's observations, it's not the turbulence that they're concerning. It's any deviation from Keplerian, like what Chris said. There's a delta V, and it doesn't have to be turbulent. It'd be nice if it were turbulent, then we would look for sort of this layer structure to show whether it was the MRI, for example. But the fact that there's no delta V is very small, brings into question even if it's a wind that's doing it. And that's sort of what worries me in this disk, is that even when you have wind solutions, you get significant velocities. Now, some of that, what's causing this, I use turbulence in quotes because it's not always turbulence, but maybe an outflow. What's causing that in these systems? Well, there's several things that are going on. At these radii, you tend to get, and I don't know if this is a fully robust resolve. I'm still running simulations to test, but you seem to get a current sheet that develops at the midplane. In the inner disk, it tends to go to one side or the other, if you're familiar with Juning's work. The outer disk, that doesn't seem to be the case. You get the strong current sheet that forms at the midplane. So this is the toroidal field, and it flips. And so you can get magnetic reconnection at the midplane, and that drives velocities, which is shown here. So these are the same plots here. Actually, sorry. I think the next two plots are just beta of 10 to the 4, but this is the kinetic energy and this is the Reynolds stress. So this is sort of the angular momentum transport that results. And you can see there's a lot of stuff induced by this magnetic reconnection.
And you're still assuming isothermal?
Yeah, this is still isothermal.
Okay.
Yeah, I can come back to that. Okay. And above, it's a little weaker because of the color scale, but there's still some velocity out here, which is due to the wind launching. Right, but I don't fully understand why it's sort of periodic. It sort of wiggles around. It could be a sort of a breathing mode or a corrugation mode. I haven't figured that out yet. These are sort of hot off the supercomputer, so I've only been analyzing them this week, apart from the discussion sections that we've had. I've been doing this all the whole time.
BZBY.
What's that?
BZBY. You plugging BZBY?
Oh, BZBY. Oh, VZVY.
What are you plugging there? What's the...
Oh, sorry, the too small. VXVY. My apologies, yes. This is just the radial Reynolds stress. I mean, yeah, if you put VZVY or any component of velocity, it shows you're basically having stuff launched azimuthally, vertically, and radially at the same time.
All three non-ideal image defects are included in this image?
Well, these are at large radii, so the Hall effect doesn't have any influence. So really, it's only, nor does ohmic diffusion. So only ambipolar diffusion here. So we don't include them, but we don't need to, is the point. Okay, so just going back to this this plot, right? So based on these calculations and what we think we're probing with these different lines, we should be seeing this down this deep into the disk. My next task is to do a more robust radiative transfer calculation and coupled with a global calculation to make sure that we actually would detect these winds, and if not, what could be an observational signature of these winds are. But it worries me that even with a wind solution developing like this, you get significant deviations from a nice laminar Keplerian flow. That's what worries me. So maybe the outer disk isn't accreting. And so there was some comments before my talk on what that might mean. If you have a viscous model, is that consistent with the age of the disk at 100 AU? And I think discussions with Lee, my impression was that it's marginal in this system, that 100 AU, the viscous time scale is roughly the age of the system, if I'm remembering that correctly. And so it's maybe not completely wrong, but it's a little worrying. I would have thought there'd be something. But then again, maybe the wind-driven accretion scenario changes how that works. I don't think we're entirely sure of that.
What if you increase the surface density?
Right. So if you increase the surface density, then you have even less FUV penetration, because it
so that would decrease the that should, magnetic activity.
What's that?
That decreases turbulent velocities.
Yes, I think that's right. Yes.
So this is the minimum mass of the nebula model surface density.
Well, this is actually a surface density modeled after HD163296, which, yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty there, right? We don't actually know the masses of these systems. So that's a good question. I mean, if we change it within the uncertainties, what would the results be? But what I've, so far what I've done, and I again apologize for the red, next time I'll choose a brighter color or a more standoutish color. But from these simulations so far, it suggests that the only way to be consistent with observations is either no ionization at all or a combination of both no FUV and a very, very weak field, beta 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7, which at 100 AU for this disk equates to 2 to 6 microgauss. So that's basically, I think that's all I have. And so the last point here is that magnetic wind-driven accretion still produces significant turbulent motions, even though it may not be turbulent, within the cold molecular disk, and we should have seen this in the first set of ALMA observations. I thought I had another... Oh, maybe I do have a couple more things. Richard Teague has looked at a different system, TW Hydra, and using a different method, and he finds turbulence in that system, upper limits of like 40% of the sound speed. But it's a different system, and it's a different method. So what's going on there? That's more work for Kevin Flaherty, my observer counterpart, than me. Although at some point it might be interesting to look at, if I model TW Hydra, will it be easier to get turbulence in that system because it has a higher X-ray flux, for example? I don't know. I haven't done that yet. Okay, now I think I'm actually to my last slide here. So we must reconcile the differences between these two systems and hopefully try to figure out why we don't see anything in the outer disk. And to do that, I think really global simulations, because those are the proper way to account for the full wind solution, and couple this with radiative transfer, not self-consistent radiative transfer, but sort of post-processing radiative transfer. And just as a reminder, turbulence still does matter, and so what transports angular momentum? Probably both, depending on the details of your model, of course. But okay, I'm done. Thanks for your attention.
So about the whole shear instability, maybe you mentioned it, but what actually leads to the bursts? I mean, why isn't it continuous? Like, why would it happen in bursts?
I don't know. It could be that the diffusion. Because if there is still ambipolar diffusion, although it's not dominant at the midplane, it may still be playing a role. And because ambipolar diffusion depends on the magnetic field strength, maybe you get enough, but then the ambipolar diffusion comes up and overtakes it, right? So the diffusion increases with magnetic field strength, and so you get a burst, but then it's quickly quenched away. Another possibility is that you get this burst due to the shear amplification, although I'm just speculating here. We haven't looked at it at all, so.
So the whole shear instability would increase the B field, and then the increase in the B field would lead to other effect then to come into play that would switch it off.
Right. So basically the idea with the non-asymmetric version is you get into the HSI unstable regime, you can grow magnetic fields from that, and if it becomes nonlinear, then, well, it's a different problem altogether, but nonlinear interactions may induce more flows, more turbulence, which may continue to feed the cycle, right? The modes that there will be some modes that get damped as it trails away, but the nonlinear interactions have excited new modes that will be amplified and sheared and the whole business like that.
So, in terms of these constraints on the turbulence, do you have a feel for, and I know it's not really what you've worked on, but do you have a feel for how important fitting the overall line profile versus fitting the spatial channel maps is, you know, what that weighting is?
How important, which one?
It's basically, are all your constraints coming from the spectrum? Just the line profile, or are all your constraints coming from the spatial maps?
It's really the spatial
map.
Okay,
it's really the spatial
map. I think the spectral thing is sort of a first order look, but you really do need the spatial information to constrain the values.
So it's sort of the follow-up question to that is, this is the sort of hell we've been living in with X-ray emission lines for a long time. Is you ask one question of the data and you get one very particular answer, but if you start to say, well, I might have turbulence and I might have winds, and my disk won't be flat, it will be flared to some degree, you can start to get degeneracies occurring in the fitting, which would allow you to go to parts of the parameter space that were...
Right, so I think other people in the protoplanetary disk community have voiced that same concern in a different guise, which is that they basically question, to fit this, we have to assume a temperature distribution. So if you change that, how does that change the results? And I think that's the major uncertainty still with these observational results. Meredith would admit that. She would probably also say that it's easier to say there's no turbulence than that there is turbulence, and then because then if there were something, you don't know whether that's thermal or turbulent. But here it's harder to get, like, it's so well fit by a no turbulent case. But I still think that your point is valid, and she, I think, would admit that the temperature, the parameterization that they use for the temperature may play a more significant role.
It's useful to know, I mean, without, you know, being agnostic to
yeah,
where the tensions lie, it's useful just to know, could you construct a model with some fiducial level of turbulence if you appropriately change the temperature profile?
Right. That's a good question. It could be. Yeah.
So when you say it could be, so you're saying that some turbulence could be masked as thermal in their fitting as temperature, even when they're fitting both the spatial things on the spectrum?
I think what their main concern is that, so in the way they do this, they have to assume a T is a function of R and Z. Right. And they showed that their data fits that perfectly well without any turbulence. So maybe you are hitting the nail on the head here. So if they had a different temperature profile, could you have a turbulent value? Again, I'm a little bit, I mean, since I'm not the observer, but...
How much do they have to tune their temperature profile to meet? I mean, do they take some completely fiducial profile and bam, it hits perfectly without any turbulence? Or do they actually have to pick some temperature profile that happens to match the data?
Right. I'm not...
If you optimize entirely for one variable, then lo and behold, it may not be surprising if you have the variable...
Right. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Jake, are they using radiative transfer type models to get the temperature structure, or are they just putting it in by hand until they fit it as best as possible? Is there a sense of self-consistency about those calculations,
They do use a temperature profile that was based on radiative transfer calculations. This is Rosenfeld 2013. So they fit the data with... They use radiative transfer calculations and show that you get this temperature distribution with very low residuals, between the data and the model, and then we use that temperature in Kevin's calculations.
It sounds like the temperature structure is coming out of a model and is not being fitted to minimize some residual or whatever.
That's right.
In it's that sense, it's fairly self-existent.
I mean, the observations, you get multiple transitions in one species, which you might think combine them and you get an exact temperature. The problem is that they form at different depths
right.
in the disk.
That's
so
right.
It is model dependent.
Yes.
Yeah.
We still have turbulence that might be stronger than observational indication in the wind case.
Mm-hmm.
Is that also true in global simulations?
Well, that's what I would like to do next.
No, haven't yet.
Well, so Jining and I talked about that. I mean, right before he left for his next venue, we had a discussion about doing just that, using his global models, running some more. We're going to run some more global models, and then put that through radiative transfer code, and yeah, because that's the real way to do winds properly, right?
Richard, yeah, just a quick question about the burstiness. It seems to me that what you're saying is that burstiness is kind of an inevitable outcome of the not the calculations, but of a self-consistent evolution of the disk. Because if you've got a lot of small grains which are well mixed, which are soaking up the charges, so that you're taking your diffusion parameters and bringing them up, so you're in a regime where you have a fully laminar disk, then it seems to me the disk will then want to settle out the grains.
Mm-hmm.
That will then change your diffusion parameters and bring you into the regime where that burstiness
right.
wants to exist. So I don't see how you get out of a situation where the disk naturally wants to have that bursty type behavior.
Right.
And I can see that you would get into a sort of...
Except that the grains, it seems to be happening at the midplane, and that's where the grains will settle. So
but they will grow as well, so the surface area associated with them will get much smaller.
Right.
So their contribution to the chemistry will also be diminished. So
that's true.
It seems to me if you were to run a grain evolution calculation in parallel with your model, you would actually inevitably arrive at that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And you could imagine it to be sort of somewhat self-limiting, in a sense that the more turbulence you get, the more
mm-hmm.
grain fragmentation you get, the more surface area.
Right.
So it kind of keeps the turbulence at some moderate level.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, if you just think about that, you know, sort of as a kind of an initial value problem, where you start off with a disk which is laminar, well mixed, and then you ask the question, how does the disk want to evolve?
Mm-hmm.
I think it takes you to where you end up.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting point, yeah. One could test this reasonably well with not a full chemical network, a reduced model or something. Yeah.
You could have a reduced model.
So wondering about TW height, where you mentioned that the turbulence they measure there is quite high.
Yeah,
but it has gaps also, right? Wouldn't it wash out
yes.
the gaps? So is it
well, it's
consistent to see both of them?
So TW hydras face on, or nearly face on, and really what wipes out the gaps would be the extended scale height, and that it's a sort of a radiative transfer effect, right? I think there is some radial diffusion too, but my impression with the HL tau argument for low turbulence is that it really was like if you poof up the millimeter grains due to some enhanced turbulence, or alpha 10 to the minus 2 turbulence, then the gaps are sort of shielded from each other. They're sort of obscured. But that only happens if you're at like a grazing angle. If you're face on, if you have vertical stuff being stirred up, then it won't change the picture. You might get a little bit of diffusion radially. I'm not sure about, but it would. The fact that TW hydra is face on means it's really hard to do that.
But the RMS
calculation
was 40%.
What's that?
The
results?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they say 40%,
so
right.
The turbulent velocity mentioned was 40% of the sound speed. What is that to alpha? That's the square root of that, right?
Well, so this would be in the upper layers,
so,
right? These are
so alpha would be
thick lines.
One. That's going to erase anything.
Right. Well, but this is probably probing only the upper layers. And if indeed there's this vertical structure of the turbulence, then you can still have settling out to the midplane because there the turbulence should be weaker. And it's just the upper layers that are going crazy. Anything else?
Sure. A while back it was baseline diagram at like for alpha, like at a radius of like 100 AU. think, and I was just wondering why you had such high alpha in that.
Oh, stop me when it comes. Oh, yeah, so this, yeah, that's a good question. Why do we have turbulence here? This particular one, we did have a really high value, or I should say low value of diffusion in the midplane. And I think this was, I never actually went back and you know, worried about this too much, because the main point was whether or not the Hall effect mattered. The diffusion parameters did come out that suggested this. The chemistry calculation we did provide diffusion parameters that allowed for this. So that is an interesting point. It could be that there's turbulence even in the midplane in these systems. So that's a good point. We just didn't say much about it.
So the MRI is not quenched here, then?
Right. That's right. It may be damped a little. I don't have the plots of the delta V or anything. Maybe damped a little bit, because there still is ambipolar diffusion. It's not fully ideal like it is up here with the FUV photons ionizing it. But it's certainly less damped than it was in sort of the fiducial models that we've run.
Thank you, Jake.
Thank you.